1 Corinthians 12:13 is not a bad place to start, because that's where the one body and one spirit connection appears most clearly, though it's in lots of other places. And it's in the course of St. Paul's great meditation on what it means to be a body with different gifts. But what struck me as I reread it most recently was that the context tells us something about what's going on. And the context, rather surprisingly, gives us some parallels with the dispute recorded in the Gospels about the disciples arguing over who is the greatest. And I may be very stupid here, I'd never really made that connection before, that the argument among the disciples about who is the greatest is very much the same kind of argument that St. Paul is stepping into in 1 Corinthians 12. Because he's dealing with a church that is marked by rivalry, by an assumption that the life of the church is essentially a zero-sum game. Some people get it right, are important, are doing it properly, and the rest are really just the ballast, at best, or an active nuisance and destructive element, at worst. So here in 1 Corinthians, just as in the parallel bit in Romans, where Paul talks about the body, at the heart of it is pushing back at the spirit of rivalry. A spirit which always asks, who has the really important gifts? What are the really important things that someone can lay claim to in the church? And I think Paul's strategy in responding to that is twofold, not just the one obvious one, but twofold. The obvious level is, we've all got gifts. But perhaps not quite so obvious level, relating to what we've just been talking about, is, and that's because we all already are in something which is overflowing in different channels and different modes. So the salient thing maybe is that at this point in 1 Corinthians, Paul isn't just attacking disunity. He's attacking very specifically competition, the winners and losers model of church life. And just in case anybody thinks that's either an abstract thing or one of those first century failings which happily we've grown out of, examine your consciences. I've sometimes said that the worst mistake I ever made in a clergy conference when I was Bishop of Monmouth organising programmes and clergy conferences was to ask one of the clergy of the diocese whose parish was doing rather well in terms of growth to talk to all the others, thinking in my naive way that they would all begin by thinking, oh, that's a good idea, instead of crossing their legs, their arms and their brows and saying, it's all right for him. And I just wonder even this afternoon whether unworthy thoughts have crossed one or two people's minds. All right for her, it's all right for him. Because the zero-sum game of a competitive spirit is pretty deeply ingrained in most of us, I'm afraid, because of the highly individualist ways in which most of us, certainly my generation, grew into ordained ministry. And that in itself is material, as John Cleese might say, or the psychiatrist in 40 Towers, material for a whole conference. So, he's not just attacking disunity. He's attacking the competitive spirit. The, my failure is your success, my success is your failure mentality. And the whole set of assumptions going with that, that there must be, surely, some things in the church that are just more essential than others in terms of what we do and how we do it. I think, in a sense, it comes out even more clearly if you go back to Romans 12 and read it against the background of Romans 9 to 11. What's Romans 9 to 11 about? It's about the church and Israel. It's about Christians who say, well, thank goodness, now we've got it, brackets, and they haven't. The Jews now haven't got it, and we have. And again, I noticed this only recently for the first time. That's the background against which the language of the body comes to the fore. because Paul has been through this unbelievably complicated argument in Romans 9 to 11, an argument full of those wonderful Pauline moments where the metaphor has got much too complicated. And you can see Paul saying, okay, right, let's, never mind, let's carry on. And it leaves a sentence hanging somewhere for commentators for two millennia to worry about. But it's against that background. Rivalry, competition. If it's us, it's not them. If it's this way, it's not that. And tied in with that, in Romans 9 to 11, and Romans 12, and 1 Corinthians 12, and so on, tied in with that is, of course, that this implies that unity is about a readiness to receive. And one thing that anxious competition and rivalry really doesn't leave much place for is the readiness to receive, because you're always going to be the person giving, because you've got it and they haven't, in case you've forgotten. Whereas the readiness to receive says, well, I've got something, but I haven't got quite a lot else. You've got something, and maybe you need something from me, and maybe we ought to do something about this together. And that, in the most pragmatic possible sense, is how the unity of the church seems to work in St. Paul's mind. And you can turn on to 2 Corinthians and his reflections there about the collection for the saints. The whole point being, when I feel I'm overflowing with abundance of gifts, what do I do about it? I look for the people who need me to share it with them, because I'm going to need them to share something with me. It's realistic. It's almost cynical at one point. Well, you know, you better get used to giving something to the church in Jerusalem, because who knows when the tables might be turned. But in any case, the whole logic, the whole direction of the church's life is that abundance moves into the need of another, and need calls out the abundance of the other. And the competitive spirit is just utterly irrelevant. And that, I believe, is the sense in which the unity of the church really is a reflection of the unity of God. Because if we're serious in talking about God as Holy Trinity, we're talking about God as a life in which there is constant giving and receiving, in which you cannot draw a firm black line around any one bit of the Trinity, or say, this is the really important bit, as if the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit sit round a table of an evening, swapping stories of how important they are and what they've achieved in the work of salvation. This is the significance of that great maxim, which I know is engraved on all your hearts and probably all your kitchen walls, Opera Trinitatis ad extra in divisa sunt. The Trinity always does the same thing. So that unity is a constant complementarity of life. And in that sense, we are reflecting it. So I begin with that as a bit of possible contextualizing of the way St. Paul talks about the unity of body and spirit, the unity of gifts, the complementary and very dynamic sense of how the church works together. It's important for him because it's part of his way of pushing back at the rivalry, the selfishness and self-assertion that characterized the church in the first century and is not wholly unfamiliar to the church in the 21st century. Well, moving on a bit then. Moving on to the one spirit. I'll start with the one spirit rather than one body and see where we get. One spirit was poured out for us to drink, says St. Paul, in a very striking metaphor. Poured out for us to drink. And that one spirit, of course, as 2 Corinthians makes quite clear in the inscription at the end, that one spirit is the spirit of communion. God pours out the possibility of communion. And I think that reference to the Spirit being poured out to drink, given the way Paul's metaphors work, is meant to bounce us back towards a number of other metaphors and narratives in the Bible. I think it clearly looks back to Isaiah 55, everyone who thirsts come to the water. But I think it also, because Paul's just been talking about this in 1 Corinthians 10, it also looks back to the rock in the desert, which is struck by Moses so that the streams flow out. I dare say it also reflects the image in the prophecy of Ezekiel about the waters flowing out from the altar in the temple. You could go on. But that is how Paul thinks, and how a good rabbinically trained first century writer would think. You need all the metaphors you can get to talk about God. But put that all together. Connect this pouring out to drink in 1 Corinthians 12 with the stricken rock in 1 Corinthians 10, and make the final link to John's Gospel, both chapter 7 and chapter 20. And the Spirit is what happens, what is released by the cross of Christ. The Spirit is poured out by the breaching of Christ's body in the crucifixion. And that Spirit is poured out when Jesus is glorified, lifted up. John 7, 37 to 39. You can't talk about the Holy Spirit until the body of Christ is broken open on the cross and the flood is released. Damagariad velomoroiv, as the Welsh revivalist hymn of the 1904-5 revival said, here is love wide as the ocean. It's all there in that hymn, actually. It really is, and it's one of the great hymns of the century. I had it at my enthronement as Archbishop of Wales, but not enough people seem to know it in England, sadly. So, the Spirit is what's released by the broken body of Christ. And it's a Spirit of communion, of communication and fellowship. And what's released by the cross of Jesus is access to being where Jesus is. And so the one Spirit poured out to drink turns out to set all kinds of trains of association running. One Spirit poured out for us to drink is the effect of the brokenness of Christ's body, made real as access to the place where Christ is. All there in the fourth gospel. So the pouring out of the flood of the Spirit, which unites us, brings us into fellowship, first and foremost, with the action of Jesus Christ. That's where the unity of the Spirit begins. One act of prayer, one act of self-giving, which is at the heart of Jesus' identity. And when his body is broken and the Spirit flows out, that's what becomes possible. That is what is shared with us. Communion is simply a fancy word for sharing, after all. That's what's shared. Christ's place, Christ's act, Christ's prayer. Into that we step, or rather, over us sweeps that flood. Surely that's why we talk about being baptized into the cross of Christ and his resurrection. Our unity is a unity in and through the self-giving love of Christ, embodied in the brokenness of the crucifixion. And to be baptized into the cross of Christ, into the death of Christ, is to be absorbed into, absorbed isn't quite the right word, but let it pass at the moment, certainly immersed in, put it that way, immersed in the prayer of Jesus, self-giving of Jesus to his Father. It's heady stuff, and it's wonderful stuff, and we ought not to forget how wonderful it is, this interweaving of image and insight and experience in Paul and John especially. I'm afraid, hopelessly old-fashioned in believing that St. Paul and St. John are talking about the same sort of thing, really. And that actually the New Testament is talking about the same sort of thing. When all's said and done about the different theologies of different bits of the New Testament, I just obstinately find the echoes will go away. anybody would believe that they were inspired to be saying the same stuff. So, now, that bringing us back to unity as a practical issue, that suggests that one of the important things about Christian unity is the freedom, the capacity, even the skill to recognize, to sense in one another the prayer and action of Christ. That unity begins not as a sort of formal thing, but as recognition. And I love the word recognition as a theological category. And actually it does go back to where we were starting about helping people see what's already theirs. Recognition is a big part of evangelism, enabling recognition. And the New Testament is, when you think about it, very full of stories of recognition. And the Easter season is all about stories of recognition and failed recognition and successful recognition and utterly unexpected recognition, as with St. Paul, who discovered in the most violent way imaginable what God had already purposed for him since before he was born. Recognition. So to recognize in another person something of the prayer, something of the action, something of the self-giving of Jesus Christ, that's the active side of unity, I think, at the spiritual level. And what's made most difference, I think, to the relations between Christians of different traditions has been far less the horse trading of official ecumenism, desirable as that may often be, than the surprised awareness that actually it sounds very like the same prayer of Jesus that we recognize and we value. There's a whole further riff one could go on to here about how the prayer of the Spirit is the Abba Father prayer. Paul says that in Romans and Galatians. The Abba Father prayer, which is prayed by Jesus in Gethsemane at the heart of his own darkness. And something then about recognizing in one another an integrity of prayer in the heart of suffering or of darkness. And maybe that's something to do with the importance in Christian unity and Christian reconciliation of valuing and loving the martyrs of another tradition. There was a whole conference a couple of years ago in Italy about the ecumenical significance of martyrs, what it meant for one church to celebrate the martyrs of another. Not least, of course, what it meant for one church to celebrate the martyrs of another who'd been martyred by the first church, which is, as we all know, a very significant part of our shared history. But what's going on there surely is seeing in the other person the martyr of another tradition, the prayer of Christ coming out of death and suffering in a way that we cannot but recognize as Christ-like and therefore mysteriously known to us already. Unity resting on recognition, recognition creating trust, trust realizing unity at level after level, and that virtuous circle, so to speak, is part of what I think true unity is about. It's why the recognition of the one Spirit, as I've said, is very much bound up with what we have to say about martyrdom. I think it's also bound up with what we say about contemplative prayer at its depths. Why is it that the people least anxious about differences between the churches tend to be the people who spend most time in silent adoration? Why is it that members of religious orders frequently recognize something in one another across confessional boundaries that many others, including the hierarchy from time to time, just don't seem to find possible? It's because of that sense of a recognition of the same prayer. And I put it that way because I think it's not just a matter of recognizing goodness in somebody else, or even of recognizing a sort of general Christ-likeness. It's really something about recognizing an act of prayer and self-gift It's going on, present in, active in another. And for them, as for me, not possessed, but inhabited. And one last thought about this unity in the spirit in this particular context. It has to do really with the significance of the Eucharist here. Because I think that the Holy Eucharist is, above all, the place where the Church opens itself up to its depths, where the Church sort of opens the cellar doors, and down there, in the depths, is the bottomless well of Christ's sacrifice and Christ's offering. And we drop our little pebbles of personal prayer into the depth. And that's where our unity lies. That's why the Eucharist is the sacrament of unity. Because we try to connect with the one act, the one self-offering. Just before Easter, we had a very interesting meeting between the Anglican and Roman Catholic bishops of England. And you're there, weren't you, John?
I'm so sorry. Wasn't actually.
I stopped.
But at one point when we were discussing certain aspects of our relationships, not least in the light of slightly problematic developments over the last 12 months, Archbishop Vincent and myself in the chair agreed that maybe one of the things we ought to do as bishops was to look at the Eucharistic prayers we used as Roman Catholics and Anglicans and just see what we could and couldn't recognise in the Eucharistic prayer. Forget for a moment some of the theological stuff we built up around those prayers. Just see if, as we studied and prayed with those prayers, we could sense the same prayer, the same offering, the same willingness to drop into the heart of things. And just see where we got from there. I don't have any illusions that at some point we'll simply fall into each other's necks and say, we are one, and go off and celebrate together. But, you know, you could do worse. And we won't get very far without that effort to recognise there, I think. And I underline that partly out of a concern, and I'm sticking my neck out a bit here, partly out of a concern that in the modern church, the modern Church of England and the Anglican Communion, we are always tempted, I think, to make the Eucharist a bit less than it really might be, because we are all concerned to be welcoming and affirming of all who come, and that's very understandable. We're sometimes nervous about having Eucharists on big occasions because we think it might be exclusive, and I sort of understand that. I just want to enter a bit of caution about ending up saying less about the Eucharist than we really need to, and making it a bit more human and a bit less divine. That is, a bit less to do with the depths of things, a bit less to do with the act of God. But as I stick my neck out there, and you're welcome to shoot me down. Well, so far, sorry I've been rambling a bit, but so far, unity and the one spirit. I think I've been pointing to Paul's use of this as a way of avoiding rivalry, unity as a willingness to receive, and unity as shown most dramatically and constructively in the acknowledgement of the same action and the same prayer in one another, relating all our divergence to that one eternal transformative action of which we see, so to speak, the historical slice, like one of those slices of tissue you put under a microscope. Historical slice in the life and death and resurrection of Jesus. And so, before I finish, I want to say a few words also about the one body as an element here. Back to Paul, where I think essential to his use of the body metaphor is the stress on how the organs of the body communicate. In other words, it's not just a plurality of gifts. It's a plurality of gifts influencing and shaping each other. Paul's not simply talking about letting a thousand flowers bloom. And there are lots of different things happening in the church, and they're all jolly interesting. He's interested in how each moves into the life of the whole, and therefore the life of others. So, unity in one body is a communicative unity, a unity of active offering and sharing, a unity of speaking, conversing. Every organ, every dimension of the body's life is anchored in something more than itself, which of course in this case is the one Christ in whom all things cohere. And the point is that if the experience of every organ of the body is, so to speak, owned by the one Christ, then it's relevant to all the other organs of the body. And that suggests both a welcome and an unwelcome implication. The welcome implication is exactly as Paul says, that when things go well for one bit of the body, that's actually good news for everybody else. Once again, the dismissal of rivalry. The possibility of things going well in somebody's parish, or somebody's local church, or somebody's province or communion, is good news for everybody else. It's not just something to make you feel worse. It's good news. The not-so-welcome implication is, of course, that when things go badly, it's everybody's problem. And without wanting to get absolutely bogged down in the politics of the Anglican Communion, a bog where I spend a great deal of my time, what makes me a little bit anxious about the attitude of those who quite like to see us divide on this line or that is that it sounds like a bit of a shortcut in the light of all this. Say we think another province is going to hell in a handcart because it's too conservative or too liberal. Well, who knows? But unfortunately, we're part of the same body. And it's just a little bit too easy to say, in Paul's language, we can do without you. And we'd much rather be with people that we know we can cope with and we know we can recognise, rather than struggling away to see what we can recognise, even in the people who seem most obnoxious, whether they come from California, Nigeria, or wherever. And the obnoxiousnesses, as you know, vary depending on where you stand to start with. So, every Christian owns the experience of every other, in some way. John Donne saying, "Every man's death diminisheth me," is one of the most profoundly Christian observations in the whole of his work. Because the spiritual crisis of any one is my problem. It's my issue. I am less because they are less. And the desire to avoid loss, cost, challenge for me by cutting off the relationship with the embarrassing other is not really what St. Paul is after, I think. And the desire for a sort of uncompromised unity is really concealing a refusal to own the failures or the problems of another. And it's something which goes right across political and party divisions in the church. It's as true of the liberal as of the traditionalist. Very often we all like to have a pure church, defined as the people who are pretty much like me, really. And that, of course, takes us yet again to Paul and to 2 Corinthians 11, though there are loads of parallels elsewhere, when Paul talks about how he, in his apostolate, is affected by what's going wrong for anyone and everyone else. Who is weak and I am not weak? Who is weak and I am not weak? Someone else's struggle is my problem. It's my issue. And my failure means that other Christians are less than they might be. And that's part of the responsibility we carry with and for each other. So, unity, in this connection, has to be that active willingness to keep communication going, with reconciliation as the ultimate goal, though, frankly, it takes us an awfully long time to get there as a rule. Even when discipline is exercised, and it certainly was in Paul's churches, it's in the awareness that when you get to the point of exercising discipline, actually, everybody's lost. Everybody's lost. It's not that a triumphant and pure church simply expels the undesirable elements, but something has happened to everybody which affects them, which makes them less than they might be. And that's why Paul, even when he's being most draconian about discipline, says the point of it all is getting back to communication, getting back to sharing. And I think that also makes some sense of what he's ruminating on so painfully and so convolutedly in Romans 9-11 about the church and Israel. Paul wants to say there something like this, I think. We seem to have got to the point of a rupture with the historic Israel. And, says Paul, if anybody thinks that's not a problem, let me tell them it is a hell of a problem. And it is a hellish problem for somebody like me, says Paul, very boldly, because that's who I am. If I'm being asked to say no to Israel, I'm being asked to say no to myself. And that is also almost asking God to say no to himself. God can't say no to himself. So what's going on? And on the argument goes. Anguished, candid, painful, uncompromising in this way. Determined to try and squeeze something out of it. And at the end of the day, Paul can't say much except that the refusal, as it now seems, of Israel to be with the new community around Jesus Christ doesn't and can't frustrate the purpose of God, that the presence of this new community doesn't overturn the purposes of God and the promise of God and the covenant, that somewhere there is the possibility of, and this is where Paul famously gets his agricultural metaphors hopelessly tangled, the possibility of a grafting together of the two streams of biological life eventually. And wonderfully and eloquently at the end of all of that, at the end of chapter 11, it says, oh, the depth of the wisdom and the riches of God. In other words, I haven't got a clue how to sort this out. But in that is the same theme. There is no health or flourishing or triumph that isn't everybody's at the very end of the day. Just as there is no failure, sin, or catastrophe that isn't everybody's. And that's because both the triumph and the suffering are owned by the one Christ who takes all our experience as his. A theme which I can't ever let the opportunity go by of quoting St. Augustine. A theme which St. Augustine, in his commentaries on the Psalms, has marvellous things to say about the way in which Christ takes to himself the words we speak to God, even when those words are words of protest and anger, as they are in the Psalms. He makes them his. And so tells us there's room for all our feelings in prayer. It's another story. So, I'm trying to wrap up these reflections a bit. The one spirit is about recognition, among other things. The one body, about communication. And at the heart of it is the one Christ, who has made our diversity his own. The diversity of our individual lives in their internal fragmentation, the diversity of our human experience in different contexts, made all his own. And so if the unity we're talking about, the unity that matters, is always to do with the one Christ, it's always to do with his one action towards the Father, his one everlasting outpouring of love towards the Father. And while the theme of Christian unity is often one that is addressed on a very broad canvas, a global canvas, it doesn't hurt, I think, for us to start by asking about how that works and how that feels in our own congregations, in our own most immediate Christian fellowship. Are we involved in those processes of recognition and communication right here and now with this group, this particular family of God's people in this parish? Is that what's going on in the life of a diocese? Is that what's going on in the life of the Church of England? Before we get, you know, into the wider realms of the communion and the other historic churches and all the rest of it, we can begin with those questions of self-examination, I think, about whether the search for recognition, the search for communication, are really happening where we are, and work outwards to the global church. And all of that is a laboured way of saying what, again, I suspect we all know pretty well, which is that the unity that matters is not something ever that we craft or negotiate, something that emerges from our efforts, but is that mysterious something we already possess and need to be brought back to, brought into, something that is already ours and we haven't ever quite recognised it. We can rightly expend effort on discovery, the study of one another — that doesn't sound too clinical — the exploration of each other's faith in the cause of recognition. We can rightly spend our resources listening hard to each other and seeking something fuller, something better. But we do it in the confidence that what unites us in one body and one spirit is the one action of the embodied spirit who is Jesus Christ. And the constant search to recover that, to let that be more and more real to us, that's where the search for Christian unity begins. So, I hope that rings one or two bells with the business of, you know, pastoring and discipling in the kind of context that we started with this afternoon. I hope I haven't rambled too far from the immediate concerns that we've been talking about, because I think that what you've been describing to me is very much what all this is about in practice, and I hope that in the time we've got left together you can tell me more about that as well as putting me straight. So, thank you.
Appreciate it.